in a position where they have to compete directly with those who are intellectually gifted. They know it's foolish and typically unprofitable to match IQ against IQ. So instead, they hire the intellectually gifted. They hire lots of them. Then they let the geniuses compete among themselves. No excuses, please. Your grades in school can no longer be used as an excuse for not becoming economically successful in America. Dr. Stanley, how much income did you generate on your best day? Extraordinary sales professional, ESP. In one day, I sold about $8 million. Earned a $240,000 commission. That's net. What was your grade point average in college? C. How many A's did you receive in college? At least one or two. I certainly would have had a lot of A's if I'd been paid a commission for each A I earned. I work for money, not A's. Note, parents, be careful what you tell your children about the future. Far too often, parents with good intentions unknowingly condemn their own children to a life of low economic productivity by telling them 10,000 times, "You will never amount to anything if you don't do well in school." Some of these children who have mediocre academic records are compelled to fulfill their parents' prophecy, in spite of their potential to become millionaires. They are sentenced to a life of low economic productivity. Their minds have been conditioned to respond negatively to cues concerning wealth-building opportunities. Thus, they act in ways that assure mediocrity or never amounting to anything. The relationship between courage and wealth. Never take counsel of your fears. General Stonewall Jackson. It's easy to understand why courage is part of the profile of our self-made millionaires, particularly the courage to take financial risk. Overcoming life's obstacles and making it to the top income levels would clearly require brave actions at some point, as well as the ability to conquer fears. How then did our millionaires acquire this courage? Is it only a genetic trait inherited from ancestors and parents, as most of us think? Surprisingly, the millionaires say no. Virtually all feel that their courage was nurtured and consciously developed all throughout their careers. And in this section, we'll learn about the various techniques that help them confront and take financial risks. The courage to take risks. What role does courage play in the process of becoming a millionaire in one generation? Almost all self-made millionaires have it because accumulating wealth required that they take risks, including financial risk, and that takes courage. One of the major characteristics of these millionaires is that they usually own and manage their own businesses. It takes courage to be self-employed. It takes courage to invest in one's own business. Most people associate high risk with these activities, and risk is the companion of fear and danger. Another part of their pattern is that, independent of the capital they have invested in their own businesses, they also own shares of publicly traded corporations. There are certain risks associated with being an equity investor. One must have some courage to invest without guarantees. It takes courage not to panic every time the stock market corrects itself. Those with little courage are too often the last to invest in an up market and the first out during a short correction. The millionaires who are senior corporate executives also have courage. If they didn't, they would never have been promoted to senior positions. They had to take some risks to succeed. What if the new product line they introduced failed to break even? Conversely, what would happen if the line broke all sales records? As one's income approaches the higher levels, it's more likely that he or she is a self-employed business owner or professional, a senior corporate executive, a sales professional paid strictly on commission, or a sales agent. But none of these vocations guarantee a surefire level of income, so many people are unwilling to take the economic risk often associated with them. For many, the downside is filled with danger. They seek the safety and security of working on a set salary. Why do those who are likely to become part of the next generation of millionaires take risk today? In their minds, economic risk-taking is a requirement for becoming financially independent. They believe the benefits of becoming financially independent greatly outweigh the risks often associated with accumulating wealth. But many people in America forego owning their own businesses, being self-employed, investing in the stock market, or even working on an incentive basis because of fear, a very strong emotion. The fear of economic failure is not easy to overcome. That's why so few people are self-employed today. They suffer through the what-ifs. What if I am self-employed but have no sales? What if my business and capital go down the drain? What if I can't support my family? What if my friends, in-laws, and neighbors find out that my business failed? The risk of failure is always present, but millionaires learn how to deal with economic risk and ultimately keep control of their fears. Paraphrasing and combining the thoughts of several self-made millionaires, this is how they respond to the idea of safety and security in working for someone other than themselves. Working for others may actually put you at greater risk. Having a single source of income, not being given the opportunity to learn how to make thousands of decisions, decisions you would have mastered if you were self-employed. Working for others, you never build your own customer base. You are not doing things that are in your own best economic interest for you to become successful in terms of becoming wealthy. You are merely doing what is in the best interest of an employer. Do you want to become wealthy in one generation? If so, you'll have to develop the courage to offset your fear of economic failure. You'll have to nurture that courage throughout your adult career. It's easy to say what must be done, but it's very difficult for the average person to develop courage spontaneously. That's why the material in this program is so important. The reason that so few people are financially independent today is that they place many negative roadblocks in their heads. Becoming wealthy is, in fact, a mind game. And millionaires often talk to themselves about the benefits of becoming financially independent. They constantly tell themselves that it is very difficult to achieve that without taking some risks. Before you can become a millionaire, you must learn to think like one. You must learn how to motivate yourself constantly to counter fear with courage. Making critical decisions about your career, business, investments, and other resources conjures up fear. Fear that is part of the process of becoming a financial success. This is especially true of those who are self-employed or have a substantial part of their wealth invested in areas that have no guaranteed return. Can people learn how to control their fears and develop courage? Can they be taught not to panic when sudden crises are encountered? If so, where will this enlightenment come from? The millionaire respondents to my national survey reported on the actions, tactics, and techniques they use to bolster their courage. I have identified more than 100 techniques that millionaires use in the game called Mind Over Fear. The most important of these activities are discussed in this section. Mr. Benjamin versus Mr. Truck. Mr. Benjamin paid all of his children's tuition. His daughter and sons all attended private elementary and high schools and prestigious private colleges, medical colleges, and graduate schools. Mr. Benjamin paid for all of it: room, board, tuition, books, and related expenses. Who is this man who demonstrated the ability to fund these enormous tuition bills? A highly paid physician? Or perhaps CEO of a major public corporation? Before he retired, Mr. Benjamin was a school bus driver. A school bus driver who generated enough income to send his children to private colleges, medical school, and graduate school. He was frugal, but being frugal is not enough to pay six-figure tuition bills. When they were very young, Mr. Benjamin realized that his children were extremely bright. He realized that each would greatly benefit from a top-quality education. So he constantly worried about funding that education with his low-paying job. Consequently, Mr. Benjamin began a self-improvement reading program. The central topic of it was investing. Being a bus driver had one side benefit. It gave Mr. Benjamin several hours of free time each day. His fellow drivers often used this time for snoozing, reading newspapers and magazines, drinking coffee, or chatting. Mr. Benjamin used his downtime more wisely. He read about various types of investments. Early in his self-study program, he discovered the truth about the long-run returns generated by corporate bonds, passbook savings accounts, treasury bills, municipal bonds, CDs, stocks, precious metals, and real estate. Relationship between courage and wealth. Mr. Benjamin concluded that after adjusting for inflation and taxes, only stocks paid a real return on one's investment dollars. But his mother had always told him never to invest in the stock market. She was around during the stock market crash in 1929. But the 1929 downturn was included in Mr. Benjamin's calculations, and he knew that in spite of the crash, in the long run, stocks outperformed all other investment alternatives. Mr. Benjamin eventually became a serious investor in the stock market. Every extra dollar he and his wife could muster was earmarked for stocks. But not just any stocks. Mr. Benjamin spent much of his free time studying specific corporations and their stock offerings. Over the years, he became an expert in his chosen avocation. The result of Mr. Benjamin's self-improvement reading and investing program was that when he recently retired, the former bus driver had a net worth in excess of $3 million. Remember, that is $3 million after sending his children to the finest, most expensive schools in America. What is the point? Mr. Benjamin became financially independent because he had courage. It takes courage to invest in the stock market. The market guarantees nothing. It goes up and it goes down. Often people get in the market late and get out early, and they lose a lot of money. Mr. Benjamin was always a long-term investor. He never let fear outweigh the knowledge he obtained from his reading program. When Mr. Benjamin bought a stock, he rarely sold it within 10 years of his initial investment. In good times and bad times, he held on to his picks. He frequently had some fears and concerns, but dealing with fear in a positive manner is a foundation stone of becoming wealthy in America. It takes courage to invest in public corporations as well as in one's own business enterprise, but often it takes even more courage to hold on to one's investments when the public mood is full of fear and panic. Without courage, Mr. Benjamin's children would not be doctors today. Contrast Mr. Benjamin's profile in courage with a fellow I refer to as Mr. Truck. Mr. Truck was working for UPS the day after the stock market recently corrected. His route was the financial district of a large city. Dr. Stanley, Mr. Truck, what effect has the sudden drop in the stock market had upon your own investing habits? Mr. Truck, none. Aren't you concerned that the market will drop even further? No, I don't own any stock. If I did, I could never sleep at night. You mean you don't even own any shares of UPS? No, I don't want to worry. I was dumbfounded by Mr. Truck's response. At the time, UPS was one of the most profitable private billion-dollar businesses in this country, and he can purchase shares in the company because he's an employee. Over the past 20 years, the stock has significantly outpaced the Dow. Could it be that Mr. Truck's fear of stocks has clouded his reasoning? Could it be that Mr. Benjamin sleeps more soundly than Mr. Truck because he has found a way to fund his children's tuition and become financially independent? It seems very likely that Mr. Truck is fooling himself into thinking he can become financially independent without taking some investment risk. There is hope for Mr. Truck only if he educates himself as Mr. Benjamin did. Mr. Benjamin's courage overwhelmed his fears of risking his investment dollars. His courage to do so is a direct product of educating himself and taking control of his own financial destiny. Why so few? Webster defines courage as mental or moral strength to venture, persevere, and withstand danger, fear, or difficulty. For most people, even the idea of being a self-employed business owner conjures up considerable fear because they perceive the situation as being dangerous. The danger of being a self-employed business owner is the financial risk associated with such a venture. One of the reasons that only a small percentage of Americans are millionaires is that only 18% of households are headed by a self-employed business owner or professional. Why are there so few business owners in America, the center of the free enterprise economy? I have asked hundreds of intelligent, well-educated, hard-working middle management employees. Why don't you go out on your own and start a business? Why don't you seek work where you are paid according to your productivity? Most of the respondents admit to asking themselves the same question. Why do they remain salaried employees? A major reason has to do with their definition of courage, meaning the absence of fear. Most believe they lack courage because they must perceive no fear, sense no danger from taking the substantial financial risk associated with being self-employed. They are wrong. I have never found one successful self-employed business owner who is completely without fear. How do I, a successful self-employed business owner, define courage? Just like all the other successful business respondents whom I have interviewed. Courage is taking positive moral actions that conjure up fear. So the true meaning of entrepreneurial material is that in spite of fear, there is the courage to go it alone. Successful entrepreneurs deal with and overcome their fears. Another misconception about courage is that, like wealth, it's usually inherited. Both assumptions are incorrect. I have found that courage may reveal itself early in a career, but many respondents have told me they were able to develop, nurture, and enhance their courage when they were in their 40s and even 50s. I have spent a considerable amount of time profiling people who have demonstrated courage, and this knowledge is very useful when I play the role of guidance counselor. People often consult me when they are contemplating the change from being an employee to being self-employed. I give them a book to read. I've probably given away several cases of the same book to those who aspire to be self-employed. Of all the courageous people I have studied, one stands out from the rest. He was Eric Hartman, the World War II fighter pilot and holder of the world record of 352 air victories. I tell my advisees to read this book because they all seem to think that people who are courageous are without fear. But this book about Hartman, The Blonde Knight of Germany by Raymond E. Tolliver and Trevor J. Constable, presents a more realistic understanding of courage, as in the following paragraph. I was afraid of the big unknown factors. Clouds and sun were hate and love. Yes, even the Ace of Aces was afraid, but he acted courageously nevertheless. Fear and courage are related. Courage does not exist in the absence of fear of some danger. If more people understood this fact, there would be more courageous business owners and ultimately more millionaires. Where is the real risk? Countless numbers of my MBA students once thought that they avoided taking much risk. Many never even considered being self-employed business owners. It was just too risky. Accepting positions with major corporations was the way to all but eliminate the risk of being unemployed someday. And why spend countless hours studying investment opportunities? The company will always take care of its middle-level executives. For many of my former students, their creed was simply to earn, spend, and let the company take care of them, for life. That was the ideal low-risk method. But they misjudged the odds, and at one time or another, most have had their middle-level positions eliminated. For example, just before Christmas one year, I was talking to one of my contacts at a large public corporation. He was quite candid about the corporation's internal changes and said, "We plan to eliminate 1,400 middle manager positions right after the first of the year." Later, I kept seeing the 1,400 unlucky families in my mind, all celebrating the holidays. Happy New Year. Little did any of them know what was in store for at least one of their main breadwinners. Several of my former students were among the unlucky 1,400. It seems ironic that these were some of my best students. Others who barely made it through the program were not offered positions with top corporations. And so, many of these marginal students eventually became self-employed business owners. They thought of themselves as economic risk takers, but were they? Perhaps my students among the 1,400 actually took more risk. Most had a single source of income and a single career track. My more marginal students have the millionaire's mind. They confronted their fears and took risks. They bolstered their decision to become self-employed business owners by constantly reminding themselves of one simple reality. Ultimately, the big risk with the long odds, the real vulnerability, is allowing others to control one's career. Why did 1,400 bright, well-educated, hard-working managers abruptly lose their single source of income overnight? because a few senior executives thought it was a good idea. Was it luck? Self-made millionaires will certainly tell you that wealth accumulation is all about taking financial risk, working hard, being disciplined, and keeping focused. However, about 1 in 8 millionaires believe that luck was very important in explaining their economic success. There's a very interesting relationship between high net worth and what respondents perceived to be luck. Only about 9% of high-income producing non-millionaires and about 9% of the millionaires with $1 or $2 million net worth believe that luck accounts for economic success. But among deca-millionaires, those with a net worth of $10 million, more than 1 in 5, 22%, believe that luck was very important in accounting for their economic success. 4 in 10 of these deca-millionaires felt that luck was important. If luck is the key to becoming wealthy, we should all take up gambling. But the luck that these millionaires are referring to is not the luck of casino patrons and lotto fans. Millionaires are not the gambling industry's best customers. Only 1 millionaire in 4 has set foot in a gambling casino in the past 12 months, and some of this patronage can be accounted for because they were attending trade shows or professional meetings in or near a casino hotel. Almost by definition, wealth builders believe that a different type of luck plays some role in accounting for high economic returns. Those who are most adamant about the role of luck feel that the harder you work, the luckier you become. That statement was written on a questionnaire completed by a respondent who was worth more than $25 million. To him and his fellow millionaires, luck relates to uncontrollable factors like weather, competition, the tightening of credit, changes in consumer income, recessions, and so on. It's worthwhile to contrast the views of self-employed deca-millionaires with those of high-income-producing attorneys and physicians. Most professionals in these categories discount luck in explaining their success. They believe it was part of a proven track record. They studied hard, received high grades in college, and were accepted to law or medical school. Then they worked hard, picked the right specialty, and invested wisely. So they became wealthy. It's almost pro forma. But what about business owners and entrepreneurs? Their success was not nearly as predictable when they started their businesses. Many will say that unexpected things happened in their pursuit of wealth. But these unanticipated events had a positive impact on their balance sheets. Some believe that intuition had a part in the decisions they made. But at the highest levels of wealth, these people believe that luck is an important correlate of becoming very wealthy in America. Luck and risk-taking go hand in hand. Risk-taking, not gambling. Ask 1,001 high-income-producing respondents one simple question. How important is your willingness to take financial risk, given the right return, in explaining your financial success? Those who answer very important are significantly more likely to have net worths in the multi-millions of dollars. More than 4 in 10, 41%, of the deca-millionaires gave very important as their answer. Only about 2 in 10, 21%, of those in the $1 to $2 million net worth category gave the same answer. How about those high-income respondents who were not millionaires? Only 18% attributed their economic success to the financial risk-taking factor. There is a clear and very significant correlation between willingness to take financial risk and net worth. The risk versus reward theory so often touted in the financial press is, once again, validated. Those who attribute their economic success to financial risk-taking are not foolish about how their money is invested, and most consider gambling to be a foolish alternative for their financial resources. In the lottery, for example, winning is a matter of chance, and most wealthy people, or those who will likely become wealthy, never play the lottery. Most never gamble. The risk-takers are not likely to be gamblers. The millionaires I've interviewed understand probability theory. In essence, they know the odds and the expected payouts. The expected payouts are so very, very small that it's better to burn a few dollars with a match each week than lay down money for the lotto. They know that in most gambling situations, especially the lottery, players have no control over the winning numbers that are selected. They do not know the odds or expected payouts, and the expected payout is less than the price of the lotto ticket. There is nothing one player can do to increase his chances of winning significantly, except by buying more lotto tickets. Other less affluent people tell me that it's only $1, $2, or $10 a week, and look at the prize. But what is your expected payout? A $1 lotto ticket with a $1 million payout may be one in several million purchased. So your odds of winning are one in several million. Say it is your one ticket against 4,500,000 others. Your chance of winning is one in 4.5 million, while your payout is only $1 million. Even that $1 million is what I call funny money, because as the winner, you'll have two choices. Your $1 million may be in annual payouts of $100,000 for 10 years. So in today's current dollars, it's not close to $1 million. Or you can take a lump sum, which is considerably less than $1 million. In essence, the real expected payout of $1 invested in a lotto ticket is a fraction of that dollar. Often, it is less than 50 cents. In terms of risk and reward, most lotto games are a consumer ripoff. There is a very significant negative correlation between playing the lotto and one's level of wealth. Decamillionaires are the least likely of all net worth categories to have played the lottery within the past 30 days, and non-millionaires had the highest percentage of lotto players for the same period of 30 days. For every decamillionaire who played lotto in the past 30 days, there were nearly 3 non-millionaire players, a ratio of 2.7 to 1. These non-millionaires are high-income producers, earning $100,000 or more annually. Could it be that if they allocated more of their income to genuine investments, they might be in the millionaire category? People counter with, it's only a few bucks a week. It is more than money, it is also time. Assume it takes 10 minutes to purchase a lotto ticket. That figure includes waiting in line and a few minutes for travel time. Assume you make one purchase per week. That translates into 520 minutes per year allocated to an activity that has a near-zero probability of winning a big pot of gold. In turn, 520 minutes translates into 8.7 hours per year. The typical millionaire earns the equivalent of approximately $300 per hour. Prorated times 8.7 hours, you can understand his reluctance to stop by the neighborhood convenience shop each week. Those 8.7 hours are allocated to more productive tasks, like working, learning a new skill, or socializing with family and friends. Computed in working time, the millionaire's cost is $300 times 8.7 hours, or $2,600 per year. Over 20 years, it amounts to $52,000. If this money was fully invested in Home Depot stock during this same period, it would have translated into multiple millions of dollars. Decamillionaires on average earn the equivalent of nearly $1,000 per hour of work. Their cost in lost work opportunity to play the lotto each week would be $8,700 per year, or $174,000 in 20 years. Imagine if this sum was invested as in the example above, the sum could be an estimated $1 million or more. Self-made millionaires know that the time and money allocated to playing the lottery can be spent on more productive activities. Too many people spend too much of their adult lives playing this game of little chance. Does such long-term loyalty make you a better, more intelligent player? Does it make you a better father or manager? The right advice, a key to reducing risk. One of the strong similarities among the members of the millionaire population is their strength in selecting advisors. This asset includes knowing when they need to consult key advisors, who they are, and how to select them. There is a strong positive correlation between finding good advisors and wealth accumulation, because having good advice reduces the risk involved in financial, career, and even personal decisions. Dr. Hart, big brain, no bucks. His call came just 2 days after my article was published in Medical Economics, July 1992. Allow me to paraphrase an excerpt from our conversation. Dr. Hart, I'm wondering when I will be able to retire. How much will I need? I'm 63, earned about $200,000 last year. Dr. Stanley. Well, as the equation in the article stated, one-tenth of your age, that's 63, times your annual income of $200,000 equals your expected net worth, or about $1.26 million. But if you are in the top quarter, you need at least twice that number, or about $2.52 million as a threshold. Dr. Hart. I don't have nearly $2.5 million, so when will I be able to retire? Dr. Stanley. That's really up to you. Dr. Hart. Well, I had a situation recently. I changed investment managers. For many years, I had a well-known asset management firm in Philadelphia manage my pension. They had discretion, but mostly invested in stocks of quality companies. Dr. Stanley. I'm familiar with that firm. It's well-respected. It's been around forever. It's conservative in its philosophy. Dr. Hart. Well, that's one of the reasons I switched fund managers. Lackluster performance. Dr. Stanley. How is your pension performing today? Dr. Hart. That's one of the reasons for my call. I have a problem. I lost everything. I mean everything. Over $1.5 million. Dr. Stanley. How did that happen? Dr. Hart, it's a long story. Dr. Stanley, I've got all afternoon. Dr. Hart, about 2 years ago I was invited to a seminar. The speaker was touring the country. It said he was a famous asset manager. He had all kinds of performance numbers and charts. The investments he managed did 10 times better than mine. I was very impressed with what he had to say. It seemed that he had a track record of making people wealthy. Dr. Stanley, what types of investments did he plug? Dr. Hart, private partnerships, investments in private companies, some real estate, some energy, high technology. Dr. Stanley, what did your CPA or your attorney advise you about these investments? Dr. Hart, I never asked for their opinions. Dr. Stanley, how did you get from $1.5 million before the seminar to ground zero after the seminar? Dr. Hart, I believed what he said. I was impressed with his numbers and disappointed in the performance of my own plan. So I switched managers. The new manager lost every dime. What was I supposed to tell this unfortunate fellow? His question was, when will I be able to retire? The answer is, perhaps never. Dr. Hart, do you by chance know someone who can do a better job managing my plan in the future? Dr. Stanley, I don't have a list of top investment advisors, not in your area, not even in my own, but I will tell you what many economically successful people do regarding investment advisors. You have an accountant and an attorney? Dr. Hart, yes, but do they know about investing? Dr. Stanley, the next time you ever even think about making changes, ask both your accountant and your lawyer for their views. If they don't feel capable of making such judgments, ask them to refer you to some others in their professions. I also suggested that he find a professional investment advisor who would be part of his investment advisory committee. The other members should include an enlightened accountant and a top attorney. Both his accountant and attorney should be able to judge the variations in quality among an ever-growing population of stockbrokers, asset managers, financial planners, and the like. Accountants often know which of their clients make money investing, and they can ask these clients who their investment advisor is. Millionaires have good advisors. Imagine that Dr. Hart had had an advisory committee intact several years before he called me. If the committee members had accompanied him to that seminar given by Mr. Famous, the so-called asset manager, perhaps Dr. Hart would be able to retire in comfort today. If he had only retained that old conservative asset management firm, his pension would be worth more than $3 million today. Even simpler, Dr. Hart could have screened invitations from investment gurus himself. If you find yourself in the same situation, telephone the guru's office and ask the following question. What percentage of your invitations were sent to attorneys? In Dr. Hart's case, the percentage was likely zero, because dishonest marketers of investments and related services have great fear of the legal profession. A multimillionaire once related this to me. They won't rip off attorneys because attorneys can sue for free. Call the sponsor and ask if you can bring your attorney. His response will give you a clue to his intentions. On the other hand, an investment expert who has high integrity and novel ideas might actually encourage attorneys to attend his presentations, and lawyers are quite often members of multiple informal investment committees for wealthy clients. Most millionaires do not have one investment advisor. They have at least three. More often than not, their CPA and trusted attorney are part of the team, and these advisors help select and screen stockbrokers, financial planners, and insurance agents. There's a built-in system of checks and balances. Stockbrokers feel compelled to give outstanding service to clients who interface with enlightened CPAs and attorneys. Poor service or bad recommendations are more likely to be noticed if multiple influential parties are involved. Also, enlightened professionals often have other clients with ventures that need capital, and some of these may have extraordinary potential for growth. But you will never discover this unless you patronize the best professionals. Most libraries have a directory of law firms and lawyers. The Martindale Hubbell Law Directory gives a bio of each attorney. In the long run, it is very beneficial to have a trusted CPA and attorney work with you throughout your adult life. Do-it-yourself patronage decisions concerning financial advisors, a la Dr. Hart, are rare among the self-made millionaire population. The Do-It-Yourself Downfall. Why do people like Dr. Hart work without a net? Why are they do-it-yourselfers when it comes to investing their life savings? The more data I collect about this issue, the clearer it all becomes. Dr. Hart was, and still is, a scholar. He was a scholar in college and medical school, and his writing and reading habits indicate that he is still a scholar today. In a nutshell, he has a high level of analytical intellect. The data about such people indicate that only a minority use skilled advisors like CPAs and attorneys when making investment and related patronage decisions. As noted before, we use SAT scores as a measurement of analytical intellect. Only about 40% of millionaires with SAT scores of 1400 and over use advisors. Yet more than 60% of those in the 1000 to 1200 range regularly consult with skilled advisors. What's the connection here? Why do some people with very high levels of analytical intellect become do-it-yourself investors? Having high analytical intellect does not necessarily guarantee a high level of practical intelligence. And part of practical intelligence relates to one's ability to make accurate judgments about people. In this regard, I suspect that Dr. Hart's practical intelligence is not very high, and he's not alone. He and his group greatly enhanced and nurtured their analytical skills in college and medical school. Physicians are the least likely of all high-income occupational groups to report that as part of their overall educational experience, they learned how to make accurate judgments about people. There are several other theories that might explain the irony of big brain, no bucks. One was summarized succinctly by a respondent in one of my focus group interviews. Money is boring. Yes, some highly intelligent people feel that way. They are more challenged, more excited about doing heart surgery or solving high-order math problems than counting every dime. Given the choice, they'd rather be in the running for a Nobel Prize than become a decamillionaire. Taking time and energy away from such pursuits in order to work with advisors is just not their cup of tea. But there is another more compelling theory. The analytical test results of people like Dr. Hart indicate that he's close to genius level. So perhaps he doesn't need any advisors. Perhaps he thinks he's smarter than any advisor. So why spend time and money dealing with these people? When it comes to investing, some people do think they are, financially speaking, immortal. Being very, very intelligent may have some drawbacks. Most high-income people with average to above-average intellect realize they aren't brilliant, but the majority have great common or practical intelligence. They know their strengths and weaknesses and act accordingly. They never make major investment decisions without first seeking advice from skilled professionals. So here is yet another set of rules taught by self-made millionaires. Never be too proud to seek advice from skilled investment advisors, especially CPAs and tax attorneys. Be more sensitive to the long-term benefits of having high-grade CPAs and attorneys as your advisors than to the short-term benefits of doing it yourself. If you're not good at judging talent, hire advisors who are. Who gives advice to millionaires? How do you make critical decisions concerning allocation of your financial resources? What type of decision process do you go through when making major changes in your business or career? If you are like the majority of millionaires, you do not make such changes without first consulting your key advisors. In the following section, we'll learn more about who millionaires rely on to give them the best advice. One of the most frequent questions that I am asked concerns sources of advice. People write and call, and the questions are similar. Who is the best source for investment advice? Stockbrokers, financial planners, insurance agents, or marketers of mutual funds? I can often tell that the caller is not a millionaire when he asks that question, because I've learned that these professionals are not the key investment advisors for most millionaires. In fact, there is a direct positive correlation between one's net worth and the use of certified public accountants, attorneys, or tax consultants as investment advisors. Take a representative sample of all high-income earners in America and look at each category of high income. That is, $100,000 to $199,999, $200,000 to $299,999, and so forth. In each category, ask the members of the sample a simple question. Who do you use for investment and related financial advice? Within each income group, respondents who have higher levels of wealth are likely to indicate that CPAs and attorneys provide them with investment advice. In fact, they are 3 to 5 times more likely to consult with CPAs and attorneys regarding investments than with stockbrokers. Note that I am referring to advice and counsel, not executing stock trades. Also, most millionaires generally don't limit themselves to stocks, bonds, and related investments. They invest heavily in private businesses and real estate. So when people contact me regarding investment and financial advisors, I tell them what millionaires tell me. More than 2/3 of the self-made millionaires in America rely on the advice of CPAs and attorneys. Of course, not all professionals in these two categories offer investment advice, so it does take some searching to find the ideal set of advisors. There is a major difference between using the basic services offered by any professional and taking his investment advice. For example, you may employ a CPA to complete your tax returns, a stockbroker to execute your trades, and an attorney to help you draft a will. These are basic boilerplate offerings. But a growing number of highly skilled CPAs and attorneys do much more than boilerplate. They provide customized investment advice on areas not just involving securities of public corporations. These professionals can be very valuable advisors concerning the tax implications of many other alternatives, from private investments to industrial real estate. Most millionaires gain their economic status in part from investing in things other than stocks and bonds. But many of these unconventional categories have their own set of risks and opportunities. It often takes intelligent, well-seasoned CPAs and attorneys to sort these things out for the millionaire. What about conventional investment categories like publicly traded stocks? Even here, many millionaires view the worlds of advice and execution of trades as being far apart. Take the results of a regional study I conducted of 185 multimillionaires. Each respondent had a minimum net worth of $5 million, and each was asked 4 questions. 1. Who has provided you with investment advice in the past 12 months? 2. How productive or useful was this advice in helping you attain your investment goals? 3. Who has provided you with any other financial services in the past 12 months? 4. What level of quality did you receive from each of these service providers? Most of these multimillionaires used CPAs, 71%. And attorneys, 67%, as investment advisors during the 12-month period prior to being surveyed. 3 in 4, 75%, rated the investment advice received from CPAs as being very useful in helping them achieve their investment goals, while nearly 4 in 5, 78%, rated the investment advice received from attorneys in the same manner. Nearly one half, 46%, received advice from a tax specialist. Of these, 82% indicated the advice was very productive. Interestingly, only 21% received investment advice from a stockbroker, but most of these multimillionaires, 62%, rated the advice as being very productive. A much greater number than those receiving advice rely on stockbrokers for other services. Nearly three-fourths, 72%, rely on stockbrokers to make stock and related transactions. Most multimillionaires also read and rely upon the research reports prepared by stock brokerage firms. One multimillionaire respondent, whom I'll refer to as Alvin, was particularly vocal about how he employs stockbrokers and attorneys, and there were many who echoed his views. Asked how he would advise someone looking for an investment consultant among the ranks of stockbrokers, he replied, I couldn't recommend one. I wouldn't recommend one. I use a stockbroker for the purpose of executing orders. That's it. I don't want him to give me any information. I don't want him to tell me what day it is or what time it is. I want a broker who doesn't give me advice, doesn't give me recommendations, just gives me the service that I want to have. I'm happier when it's done that way. The only service Alvin needs from his brokers is executing trades and supplying him with research reports written by investment analysts and other experts. That's why so many Alvins I have interviewed are now using the Internet for investment information as well as for trading. How did Alvin find stockbrokers who act according to his mandate? You don't find a stockbroker who handles it that way. You train a broker to handle things like that for you. Alvin reads a lot of research reports before making any changes in his investment portfolio, but he often asks his attorney as well as his CPA for their input. In general, Alvin believes in hiring the top attorneys from the top law firms in his geographical area. He finds that this is the fastest and most economically productive way to hire talent. He tends to hire law firms that are the largest, the best, and the most influential, because he believes that the bigger the better, and the best law firms hire the best people. The biggest and best firms are filled with skilled specialists, and Alvin relies on specialists who know a lot about tax-advantaged investments. Can hiring a top law firm be prohibitively expensive? Not according to Alvin. I've dealt for many years with individual lawyers, one-man firms, or some small law firms, and by and large they tend to charge me the going rate, hundreds an hour, even if they're reading a law book. Whereas Alvin says, I go to the biggest firm and they have specialists in every field, and if I want to know about the offshore deals, they got a guy down there who knows all about the offshore deals. I call the senior partner at a top law firm and I say, Charlie, I want to talk to somebody about offshore. He says, we got a guy. So I went down, spent a couple hours with him. So for less than $1,000, Alvin received 3 hours of sound investment advice, and for him, the benefit received from that fee was well worth it. Also, as a result, Alvin has fully adopted Rule 20. The tax attorney offshore expert always tells Alvin the same thing. Alvin, invest if you want to offshore. If you really want to, we'll eventually get you out of jail, even if it takes 20 years. Humor the cold caller. It was one of many calls I received at the university that day, but this one was unique. Caller. USA Today quotes you, gives the size of the millionaire market in each state, even the number living outside the country. I just want your list of the names and addresses of America's millionaires. Dr. Stanley. I don't have a list. Those numbers are estimates. The figures are generated by a statistical model. You don't think I'm going to count every millionaire one by one, do you? Caller. I want to buy your list. Can I get it on labels? Dr. Stanley. I don't have a list. As I told you, I'm not in the list business. The fellow who called was a cold-calling salesperson who targets millionaires. He markets tax shelters, tax-advantaged concepts. He called me 8 times. During the first 7 conversations, I told him the same story. That is, I'm not in the list business. During one of these conversations, I suggested that he take a different approach. Dr. Stanley. Most wealthy people rely upon the judgments of their accountants and attorneys when evaluating the type of investments you offer. Why not contact CPAs and tax attorneys? If they like your ideas, they may endorse your products. Caller. CPAs, they are deal busters. None of them want to take any risks. They won't let their clients do anything out of the ordinary. No guts. Their clients are paying too much tax and they do nothing. They are deal busters, that's all. Dr. Stanley. Well, most CPAs are well versed in the tax codes. Some CPAs even have law degrees and specialize in tax issues. The last thing they want is for their clients to get audited. Caller. As far as I'm concerned, if you're not audited every year, your accountant is not doing his job. You gotta be willing to take risks. There are still a lot of gray areas. As you can imagine, this guy and his offering would frighten even seasoned investors. I know he scared me, even though he never attempted to sell me a tax shelter. After his seventh call, I decided that I must take a more aggressive posture. During the eighth call, placed to my home on a Saturday morning, the following conversation transpired. Caller, have you made up your mind? Do you want to become a wealthy man? I want your list, and I'll pay big numbers. Dr. Stanley, okay, you win. Let's start with a test list. Then you can see if it fits your needs. You're based in New York, so how about New York's millionaires? Caller, I knew it. I knew you had the list. Can we start with New York City? Dr. Stanley, even better, how about Manhattan? Caller, how many millionaires live in the borough of Manhattan? Dr. Stanley, about 33,000. Caller, how much? Dr. Stanley, how about 10 cents a name, including street addresses and phone numbers? Caller, it's a deal. I need it soon. Dr. Stanley, I can send it overnight. Just give me your Air Express billing number. I'll include an invoice for $3,300. That's 33,000 names at 10 cents each. Caller, it's a done deal, like white on rice. On the Monday following this conversation, I prepared an invoice for $3,300 and placed it in an overnight package, but also included was something else. I enclosed a 2-year-old Manhattan telephone directory, the White Pages. The package was received by Mr. Caller the next morning, and as expected, he immediately telephoned my office. He was unhappy. Dr. Stanley. Hello, this is Tom Stanley. Caller. This is not a list of blankety-blank millionaires. What the blankety-blank are you? This is a blankety-blank telephone book. I'm not paying you blankety-blank. Dr. Stanley. Actually, it is indeed a list of millionaires. About 1 in every 70 people listed are millionaires. The list I sent you is much like yourself. Both you and the list are unrefined. To date, the caller has yet to send me a check for $3,300. He never even returned my telephone directory. In fact, he has never contacted me since he complained about the unrefined list. Changing the odds. What are the odds that the business venture you're considering will bear fruit? Are you the type of person who will take financial risk given the right return? Perhaps you think you lack the courage to venture, or you believe the odds are too long. Before you question your courage, consider this fact. Most millionaires who take risk do many things to increase the odds of winning, some of which are described in this section. Their own business. Most decamillionaires attribute their wealth to owning and investing in their own rather than in other people's businesses, which include the ones listed on the various stock exchanges. The millionaires state that they can control their own businesses, but they can't control or dictate policy to public corporations, let alone determine prices in the stock market. Most will also tell you they believe they are better able to operate a particular type of business than anyone else. The particular type is the key element here. Successful risk takers are market nichers. They do things that others do not do, or at the very least, they do things in a market area where there are few competitors. It's interesting to contrast those who are self-designated risk takers with those who attribute their success to other elements. Risk takers are significantly more likely to rate certain other factors as critical in explaining their economic success. For most financial risk takers, the really long odds are involved in investing in other people's businesses. Their philosophy is that the best people to work for are me, myself, and I. Otherwise, they are at the mercy of someone who may not be sensitive to their needs and financial goals. Business owners are the most frequent of all high-income groups to give credit for their success to their willingness to take financial risk. Senior corporate executives are in second place, followed by physicians and, finally, attorneys. The majority of these risk-taking professionals are self-employed. The right niche. In the 25 years I have studied millionaires, I have discovered that they do a lot to reduce the risk associated with being self-employed. In all the years that I have studied the wealthy, I have rarely found a multimillionaire who tells me, "I just thought it would be a good idea to be self-employed. I just thought that I would like to become an excavation contractor, or a wholesaler of fish oil, or a sandblasting contractor." Almost all the self-made multimillionaires whom I have interviewed had some experience, some leverage in the vocational area they selected. Many studied the profitability of various types of businesses before making a decision. Financial risk takers are nearly twice as likely to have studied the profitability of different businesses before they took the entrepreneurial plunge than non-risk takers. And they were very likely to have an understanding of the growth and income potentials of different ventures. In essence, risk takers succeed in part because they do a lot of homework before investing. They also seem to have some intuition about the category of business that they would enjoy. Most often, it is at least a two-step process. Risk takers first select an industry for which they have some affinity. It's more than money. It is a feeling of belonging. They often begin their careers as employees and then have some intuition about their affinity for that industry. As a second step, risk takers develop a business concept. Affinity, knowledge of the industry, training, experience, and just plain old contacts with potential customers and suppliers are the influential factors. What is the real risk of starting one's own business under these circumstances? It's much less than most people imagine. Moving from being an employee to a self-employed supplier within the same or related industry is much less of a stretch than mastering a vocation and industry that are new to you. It's much easier to succeed if you like the business, industry, and people who are part of your enterprise. Financial risk takers are nearly twice as likely to attribute their financial success to love of their career or business than are risk avoiders. That sixth sense, opportunity. Financial risk takers often have a special sensitivity, and they see business opportunities that others do not see. Time after time, when I interview a group of self-made millionaires, a pattern emerges. The respondents with the highest levels of wealth give credit to their ability to recognize opportunities that other people do not appreciate. The so-called risk takers know how to reduce the odds of failure and enhance the probability of succeeding by investing in business categories that others avoid or don't appreciate. Competitors stay away because there is a perceptual barrier. They just don't see the light. A detailed discussion of how millionaires select business opportunities is given later. Countless numbers of successful people can and do see what others can never perceive. Along these lines, consider the note that I recently received from the son of a man who had a great eye for economic opportunities. It was such a keen sense that it countered his bad experiences as a child. "My father died last year. I'm sure he would have been glad to fill out your survey. He never went past the sixth grade. His father and teachers hit him constantly. He went from hell to hell. He built this corporation, picture of headquarters enclosed. He helped many in my family build businesses from shops and garages into factories. He saw opportunities people walked past every day. RJR, President." Even if you see great opportunities, it takes courage to capitalize on them. It took courage for a fellow who dropped out of school in the sixth grade to even think that he could build several multi-million-dollar businesses. The actions of his father and teachers were not ego-enhancing, confidence-building experiences, but his vision of opportunities overcame the negative actions of authority figures. In some cases, the instinct for recognizing business opportunities is so strong that it outweighs criticism and other impediments. Such instincts can enhance one's courage and resolve. What if you are the one with the great idea that others don't appreciate? How can you persuade them to follow your lead? Most economically successful people have some ability to sell their ideas to others. It is a hallmark of successful business owners and senior corporate executives. But they also know how to identify people who will most likely be persuaded to follow their lead. People of courage. One of the finest examples of the balance between courage and vision was the strategy Ray Kroc initially employed in selling McDonald's franchises. It was based on finding people with courage. Believe it or not, Mr. Kroc once found it difficult to sell what is today the trophy of franchises. But he had vision. He saw what few others could, even before he started selling franchises. Mr. Kroc instructed his secretary to send in all cold-calling sales professionals. Who were these people so intent on selling him everything from life insurance to Bibles? Mr. Kroc knew that cold callers are people with courage and guts. He assumed that if they had enough courage to sell via cold calls, they certainly had the guts to purchase and operate a McDonald's franchise. And he was correct. An excellent discussion of this selling the sales professional is detailed in John Love's outstanding book, McDonald's, Behind the Arches. The book is required reading for those who wish to understand the meaning of vision.